Welcome back to Arts About.
Show about art that's a work of art in progress.
Oh.
Up in the air, so to speak.
Yes, it is always. We are juggling balls in here this morning, folks. Arts About is, of course, brought to you by the generosity of the McClelland Sculpture Park and Gallery and facilitated by the Bendigo Bank Studio. You're listening to me, Sally Bailiw, and artist in residence and cultural sounding board John Baird, and the amazing and controversial Mark Stewart, and, of course, with the man behind the curtain, Brodie Gouzet, on the buttons, keeping us on air.
G'day, Mark.
G'day, John. Hi, Sally.
Hey there, you two. What are you going to be talking to us about today, John?
I don't think we've had enough of a look at Jim Dine, so we're going to have a bit more of that.
Oh, yes. Okay. That's fabulous. And Mark, you?
I'm going to talk about Madonna's knickers.
Of course you are.
Yeah.
The religious knickers. Icon or the singer?
Well, both if you like, but more just a very brief talk about the Madonna, the singer.
Brief.
Very funny. Very good. Well, we've got a couple of great guests for you this week too. We're going to be talking to Joe Turner. He is an actor who is playing the character Antonio, I should say, at the centre of the controversy in The Merchant of Venice. That's Bell Shakespeare's production that's coming to Frankston Arts Centre on the 19th of August. We're also going to be talking to a filmmaker, Adam Mackey. He's part of a group that are a group of filmmakers based here on the Mornington Peninsula who are launching a book, and from that book hoping to make a feature film. So he's going to come into the studio in a minute. So while we get him in here, I thought I might play a little track for you here. It's called Despacito. It's a song with a video clip attached that has made incredible waves this year. In January, Universal Music Latin Arm released the video of Despacito, which is actually a Spanish word that means slowly, showing the artists in La Perla, a neighbourhood in San Juan, Puerto Rico. And within a few short months, it's reached 3 billion views on YouTube.
I didn't think there were that many views available.
Isn't that incredible? 3 billion people have listened to it. I think there's something like 3.3 million sales or streams that have been sold from this thing.
Have you listened to it,
sir? I have listened to it, and I'm going to play it for you right now.
And see it is the video, is it because of the music or the video that's had such popularity?
I think it's the music actually, although it has a very sexy girl dancing in it.
Because that was my next question.
Yes, it does.
Are there any sexy girls
in Latin America? I think there are. Here they go. This is Despacito. Well, our next guest has really enjoyed that track because I've just heard off air that he's a Latin dancer. So we've made him feel right at home. Our next guest is Adam Mackey, and he's come into the studio today to talk about a rather curious project. He's a filmmaker, or he's with a group of filmmakers who are based on the Mornington Peninsula called Angels Leap. They have collectively written a book called Mary Poser, which is about to be launched at the GPO on August the 20th. And it is from that book that they hope to make a film. Good morning. Welcome to the show this morning, Adam. Thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you for having me here.
Really curious, this idea that there's a group of people that have written this book. Can you talk us through the project a little bit?
Well, it started off as a script. So we did actually start filming in Nashville for the script, and we wanted to do a trailer so we could take that to the Cannes Film Festival and then sort of see if we can get our funding and, you know, sort of get a bit more growth and sort of development. And everyone who's looking at the project said, look, the project's really good, but you either need an A-list actor or an audience first, and then that would give the investors confidence. And so we thought, okay, well, let's look at this stage of, you know, developing an audience. And so the book then was then come as being the next element.
Oh, my goodness. So the book is an element of of that process.
Yeah. So if the book is successful, fingers crossed, then it helps us then to go back to Cannes and or any festival that, you know, we choose, which is an industry festival, and then say, right, here's the, you know, the story, here's the audience, here's the enthusiasm behind it. Up to 30% of commercial films are based on a book or graphic novel or a story that already exists. So we're looking to see whether this is going to be a successful formula for this project.
So you're going to fit that space retrospectively, so to speak.
There are plenty of times where a book is created from a script. But yeah, we're sort of halfway in between the two.
It's a fascinating.
Yeah, when we got good support. So they said the story was good. So it's okay, well, we'll, you know, leave it with us. We'll get back to you.
So the story, Mary Poser, what is the story? Who is she?
Well, she's a girl in Nashville where we wanted to see about creating an impossible love triangle. And so in her case, because she's Baptist, she has a Baptist father, she's a steakhouse foodie, she's into country and Western music. And so we thought, well, what about if you put a Bollywood director in there who happens to be Hindu and a vegetarian and they fall in love with each other? How's that going to go?
Mm.
And so, you know, the great thing about a good story is what's often referred to as Deus Ex Machina.
Deus
Ex Machina.
Latin for?
God in the machine.
Right.
Or God of the machine.
Right.
Okay. It's also so Latin for a beautiful motorbike.
Oh, is it?
Yes, yes. It would be a good name for a motorbike. And so what you do is you get the most, unlikely scenario, the most impossible scenario, and then you create a solution. And that's the God of the machine.
Okay. Yeah. So the script existed first. Yep. Where did the script come from?
Angel A.
Right. So it was collectively written by your production company.
Yes, yeah.
Ah, I see. Now you're based here on the Mornington Peninsula.
Yes.
Are you all filmmakers or are you writers?
No. The writer did the most work when we did a French film called Le Sœur de l'Ange. We filmed in Corsica in France. She's French. Based in France, and so I was working in Paris and doing some study in Paris, and we just thought I found a metaphor that really worked, which is now the name of the company, which is Le Sœur de l'Ange, which is Angel's Leap, and so we turned that into a story in itself and created a film, and that went really well as a short film, and now we want to move forward to a feature. And it's, if you want to do a good feature, not just any feature, this is, seems to be a reasonable process. So we're going through that process.
Mm. We had, I imagine you probably came along and saw the Peninsula Short Film Festival if you were in town.
Yes, I've seen a few times, yes.
Okay.
And Steve Well.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, while we were there, I was just talking with Fred Skepsy, and he mentioned exactly what what you mentioned a little earlier, which is that there is this dynamic now that you either have to have an A-lister or several B-listers, and you never know who's going to be on the A-list and B-list week to week, and that there are these building blocks that investors insist upon in order to kind of fund your project, which sounds utterly horrific and utterly against the artistic practice of the process of actually creating a film that gets in your way. So, you know, clearly you have to grapple with these horrible market things. How's that going?
I can totally relate to that. And actually, Fred's been a great mentor for me because, you know, when you are working independently, you know, you sometimes do just get a little bit tired of the whole, there's so many hills you have to climb. And so he, you know, gave some good insight into that level for me to realize you got to relax and just not put too much pressure on yourself and just keep chipping away at things. I was like, for one example of what you're saying, I'm sitting on a Gothic romance that it's a big project and the budget is way bigger than this. And, you know, you take it to the festivals and they say, well, this is in at the moment. Can you put this in? And I say, no, we can't. You know, and they were, even one suggestion was to film in Hawaii. You know, it's a Gothic romance. You know, it has to be, you know, somewhere, you know, because it was cheaper to film in Hawaii. And I just thought, no, look, this is crazy. So this, I think, gives a little bit of power so that level can't come in and say, oh, could you change this? Could you fix that? Could you move that? Because the story's now going to be from August 21. It's going to be out there. So we can't make those changes. So it actually puts us back in the driver's position to say, this is the story. We have to honour the story. Please just help us.
Are you still working with the French woman?
Yes.
So you have Canal Plus or somebody helping you? Or not?
We would if we were going to film in France. So when it comes to the Gothic romance that I'm sitting on, we would likely film in France because it's set in Geneva.
Okay.
And so we would probably do 90% of the filming in France and then just swap across for the location shots in Geneva. So Canal Plus and people like that would be awesome.
Yes, because they do help enormously. I mean, the state government, the French government does help filmmakers.
And we have an agreement in Australia between us and France too, so for co-productions.
Okay.
So let's say we want to do post-production in Australia because our post is amazing in Australia. We've got a great house down in Melbourne called Allura and a few others. So we could do it as a co-production with France. So if Canal Plus wants to give me a call, not a problem.
So with the book, I'm just sort of not sure how this works, but the book is produced, written and produced.
Yes.
And that gives you an opportunity, presumably not going to raise enough money out of writing a book to make a film.
No, it's just the audience.
So you then build an audience. Is that the way you... do you go to crowdfunding or something like that?
I've looked at crowdfunding. We may still do that. You know, you can at any stage bring in crowdfunding because you could do crowdfunding to actually fund printing of a book. But if you're printing on demand, it's not necessarily an issue. But if we get to a point where there's a good audience and there's everything's rolling along well, and we want it, then say, well, now we need to take it to the next level of film development, then do crowdfunding for sure.
So does an investor look at the response that the book's getting it in order to be encouraged into putting money into a film?
As you would, investing in something, you would want to see, well, what's the likelihood that people are going to like this? You know, or is this a good idea? Give me something to let me know it's a good idea other than your own testimony.
I only ever invest in things that are doomed, I'm afraid.
So don't ask John, all right?
Okay, no problem.
So Mary Poser, who's this story going to appeal to?
Probably females mainly. It's a romance essentially, but there's a multicultural element and there's a very strong spiritual element in the fact that she's Baptist, Christian, he's Hindu. And so these elements of both the clash and as well as the similarities come through in the story a lot. We get a much more insight into Hinduism in the book than we do in Christianity because it's likely going to be Christians reading the book looking for new information and how it may relate to their own beliefs. So people are into that, you know. And look, we've had a lot of reviews so far, which have actually, a lot of them are really encouraging. And so I've put them on the website. That's maryposer.com. And, you know, you can do a thing called NetGalley where you put it out to industry people and they review it and then they put their reviews out. And so, you know, we just repost them and it's been great.
Is it a big production? Is it going to be? Is it a big, like an expensive film to make?
Well, that's really, it comes down to who's involved because, you know, if we got a big A-list to be involved, absolutely. If we don't and we stick to more B-list, but, you know, we've got a strong story base, then no, we can do it quite cheaply, particularly in the digital world.
And you're doing, why is it based in Nashville? What's the
Well, I was in Houston. Angels Leap, the film, Le Soir de l'Ange, had thankfully won an award there. And so I thought, turn up. And then a couple of us went across to Nashville where there was another film festival, an event. And so in participating, we just sort of got an idea of the culture and just thought, look, it's a beautiful, rich and musical and colourful and welcoming. And it just, this idea came in about what have you put a spanner in the works here? Yeah. How would they cope?
It's interesting. Why Nashville though? It's a very strange town. I think there's about 650,000 people population, and people like Al Gore live there, and Nicole Kidman.
Well, it's Music City.
It's Music City.
Yeah, so it's the country music. Yeah. It's the identity of the city is quite, strong. You know, it's people have been there, know what it represents. And so to put something different in there with such a strong cultural identity.
Are there Hindus living in
Nashville? Oh, yes. Yeah. Actually, the temple that's mentioned in there actually exists. There is a Hindu temple in Nashville.
Okay, so you're launching this book, Mary Poser, at the GPO, which is the bar restaurant in Rosebud, on August the 20th.
Yes. Yep.
And Adam's also given me a copy of the book here. And... actually, that's the other thing I wanted to ask you about, the writing process. It's because it's credited with Angel A, so there's not a single writer.
No.
No.
Yeah, so that's, I guess Angel A is a brand that has been done before. We're not making this up. So I think, I can't think off the top of my head, there was a book series, and it was written by a group of writers, and it was always the same name of the author. And we just got stuck because, you know, some of the authors want to be pen names. They just want to write. They don't want to do what we're doing right now.
Yep.
They're often very introverted people and shy, and I respect that. And so I think, okay, well... someone's got to get out there and, you know, help the story go. So I'm really working as a producer/director.
Yep. And who else is part of your team?
Well, these pen names.
Yes.
Yes. So that's...
Oh,
that's
so they're pen names. They don't want to be known other than...
Yeah, that's why they want to know. They just want to be known as part of this. So,
okay, fabulous. Yeah. Well, we have a copy of the book here that Adam has brought in with us today. If any of our listeners would like me to send it to them, contact me on Facebook. I'm first person to do so. We'll forward that. We will also put a link, of course, on the Facebook page. The launch is at the GPO. It's a free event, but you're asking people to get tickets for it because I guess you have limited numbers. Is that correct?
Well, there's an option within the tickets. Yes, you could just turn up. But the other option is if you go to our booking, which is on our Facebook page, which is the Mariposa Facebook page, you can get a copy of the book and a glass of champagne for $24. The book itself is normally $29.99.
Yep.
So that's probably about $40, $45 worth of value for $24. But I've got limited numbers of that.
Okay, correct. Yeah,
but all anyone else who books a ticket, one of the free tickets, they'll go in the draw to win one of 10 ebook copies because we've got the, you know, we couldn't do the.
You got it all covered.
You sure have. Oh,
I'm exhausted.
I'll bet you are. This is sensational. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us today, Adam Mackie.
Thank you for the invitation. Appreciate it.
Mariposa at the GPO, the book launch, August the 20th, which is, I'm not sure what day that is.
It's a Sunday.
It's a Sunday. Yeah. I'll put a link to everything on our Facebook page. Wonderful to talk to you today. Good luck with
you.
It.
Yeah, thank you for your time.
Thanks.
And now it's time for John On.
I just look forward to that every week.
Do you know where our Swanee is at the moment?
No, I've got no idea.
Probably right at this very moment, swimming in the Mataraka Springs.
Oh, I've swum there. It's beautiful.
Where are they?
South of Alice Springs.
North of Alice Springs.
Yes, I've swum there as well.
Yes,
yeah,
the North hot of springs. Catherine. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful place.
In 1972.
Yeah, it's probably a bit different now.
You would have been able to see your BMW motorbike from underwater in those springs. The water's very clear.
Yes. It's incredibly clear, isn't it?
It was covered in red dust, so.
Right. Yeah. Now, Jim Dine, who I'm going to continue with a little, it's interesting that he's made this massive donation to the NGV, 295 works of art.
Mm-hmm.
They're prints, but they're artist-made prints, and he's given them to the NGV.
Are they those prints which are on show now, or
most of that show is what he's gifted to the NGV?
Very kind, generous.
And it is a massive gift, and people aren't really paying all that much attention to it, which is sort of interesting. Mr. Dine himself is a major world artist. And he's credited, amongst other things, with the beginning of the happening scene, you know.
Is he?
Yeah.
Tune in, drop out.
Well, he was described as a pop artist. He didn't like that. He's not a pop artist. He's more of what he describes as a neo-dadaist, or was, in the 1960s. But in 1959, he... had a happening, and I'll just read this out. This is
I'd like to hear this.
The artwork was called The Smiling Workman, and it was a happening in 1959 where Dine wore painter's clothing covered with red, blue, and gold paint, while his face was painted gold and red with a clown's mouth. And during the 30-second work, he painted the words, "I love what I'm doing, help," onto a canvas and drank what looked like paint from a paint can. It was actually tomato juice, before pouring the rest of it over his head. At the end, he jumped through the canvas he had just painted. By destroying his own work, Dine firmly centred the artistic identity of this piece as the performance and not the product. So, Mark, if you're going to have people seeing you as drinking paint, if you want to look like you're drinking paint, tomato juice is the go, apparently.
I find a lot of those happenings they were doing in the 50s and 60s really not very interesting.
Well, regardless of the merit of that particular performance, it was something that allowed people to begin a world of happenings, and that led into, of course, into performance art, which makes up a major part of what we're experiencing these days as art.
Have you seen? Can you tell me of any performance art you've seen that you remember?
It's not a matter of what I...
No, no, come on, answer the question.
It's like a school teacher, isn't it?
But it's something that I was at. Performance art, not really, no, I don't embrace it. I don't hunt it out and I don't remember anything.
No.
Is it the same as immersive theatre, do you think? Or is that an extension of it?
There are a lot of similarities. The happenings were really, the whole idea behind it was that there was nothing to be bought or sold.
And that was the reason it began, was because they were against, in the 50s, 60s, it was all against, they were against the galleries, they were against the whole commercialization of art.
Well, they were also, Jim Dime's case, he was particularly appalled by the kind of, the serious nature of abstract expressionism in New York. Mm. He couldn't believe how people were going and standing around with glum looks on their faces, mm-hmm. and he wanted to introduce a little bit of theatre, as you suggest, Sally, and sort of to marry theatre and art.
I have a piece of a happening that I was at that I remember.
Really?
It was an LSD Fog production.
Of course.
Of course it was. Mm. And it was a nighttime event in a room where he had sewn about 8 sheets together, and there were lots of holes in the sheets, and that went down over people's heads. Or you came in underneath the sheets and could poke your head up through the sheets, and there were projectors that were projecting down onto the white sheets. So in effect, you kind of had collars with all of this coloured light and other people's faces appearing in it while everybody's dancing and listening to music. That was quite memorable.
Yes, it reminds me of Luna Park in the old days. But I also went to a good happening, which was, what's her name, Marina
Abramovich.
Abramovich. Yeah. It was in the Serpentine Gallery in London in 2011, and I was with my 12-year-old daughter, and you had to leave your phones and your anything, a wallet or anything in a locker, and you had the key. You walked in with sound cancelling headphones into this space, which was filled with people walking very slowly and sitting on chairs and lying on beds, and Marina was there sitting on a chair and smiling at people.
Oh, lovely. Okay. Yes.
And so I thought it was relatively interesting, but my daughter thought it was very lovely. She
did
found
she?
It quite interesting. Well, and she was giving people massages, and you know, it was all quite lovey-dovey, but...
Well, of course, she did the piece
at the New South Wales Gallery.
Dark Mofo, which was before the piece in the New South Wales Gallery down at Mona. And it was preceded by a very similar ritual, which was to remove your phones and all pieces of technology, put a set of headphones on, and then go into a huge room in which there were 4 or 5 very big wooden tables with benches there and lots of different coloured pieces of rice. And you could do whatever you like with them. You could separate them.
That's right, the same. I forget the rice. It was the same thing. What she did do initially in the 70s was at the New South Wales Gallery with her husband at the time was stand naked in the entrance of the
squeeze through past
and you had to squeeze through.
Oh, I went to the Metro in New York, and I went to the... it was a retrospective of that. It was the artist is present, so was where she was seated on a chair, and people could come and sit in front of her for however long, 10 minutes or however long they wanted to. And she was there for 6 weeks, which was rather remarkable. But there was a retrospective on at the same time with quite a lot of her works there. Mm. And they had that piece. And there were 2 naked people, a man and a woman, and you had to squeeze between them.
Between them, yeah.
To get
and
through.
You had to choose which
and you
one
had to
you'd
choose
have
who
to...
you were going to face, yes. And I watched for some time. It seemed mostly women faced the men and men faced the women.
Strange. And I have to say that the point that I'm making, I suppose, is that we have Jim Dine really to thank for that, you know, for all of that work.
No, he wasn't the first happenings.
He was amongst the first.
One
1959,
of the, first.
The Smiling Workman was certainly amongst the first art performances.
Really? Well, I have to check up on that, John.
Please do.
And we also have to thank him for his very generous donation to the gallery, too, which for some reason he's not
been spoken
about.
His graphic work, which is... this is a man who has chosen... Maybe, what do you think? There are 6 or 7 motifs, do you think?
Yes, the hearts, the tools,
because
he grew up with his parents who owned... his grandparents who owned a hardware store in Illinois, and he remembers all the tools, so there's a lot of stenciled spanners and things, which are actually quite beautiful. And his hearts are what he's most famous for.
The robe
as well.
Yeah, I loved all the robe images.
Yes, which I think he got from Balzac, from Rodin, because Rodin was trying to make his portrait of Balzac, which is in the Boulevard de Raspail in Montmartre. Rodin was having enormous problems until he put on a bathrobe on top of the sculpture, and he said, "That's it, I've got it."
Mm.
And the French hated it, of course, but now they love it.
Mm. Well, Jim Dine says that the robe is a representation of him because it's an object that he can use as a graphic motif, but it is also a personal piece of personal clothing, you know, so it's a self-portrait in a sense.
Yeah, that doesn't really do much for me, I'm afraid. The whole idea, what's a bathrobe got to do with anything?
Well, what's any of it got to do with anything? What do tools have to do with anything?
Or? I mean, this comes back to your initial question about, you know, no one seems to be too concerned about Jim Dine, and it is that, it's like this, the Adam talking about, you know, if you don't have an A-lister, then you're not going to be seen. It's the same thing. You really have to be doing something quite powerful to have any importance at all.
No, what it has to do with, Mark, is the relationship between an object and the viewer, and what the object needs to do in order to keep the viewer's attention or to have some sort of exchange with the viewer,
right?
And which gets down to really design and graphic work, you know, which he's very good at, and because they're often beautiful objects, some of them are a bit disappointing, but they're impossible to walk past. The skulls, particularly, are very, very difficult to walk by.
I'm just so sick of skulls. God, everyone's doing them. It's unbelievable.
Okay.
What?
You're going to get really angry in a minute if we don't start.
Are we running out of time?
Yes,
I'm
most
fine.
We are.
Madonna's knickers can wait.
Oh, can they? All right. Then.
Anyway, look, what I'm trying to say, I suppose, is that they're all on the wall at the moment at the NGV, mm-hmm. and if
on
you
the
haven't
floor,
seen
I
the
haven't.
Jim Dine show, then you really need to go and have a look. It's something that we've been gifted, and he's a major artist and needs to be at least paid the respect of looking at.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful show. It really is, and it's on the third floor at the at the end there, and it's just a lovely space.
Yeah,
and he fills it well. Okay, so I'm going to talk about another exhibition.
Mm-hmm.
Which is Blood, Attract and Repel at the University of Melbourne. Apparently it's created a few...
Is that at the Potter Museum?
It's at
the Potter Gallery at
It's not the Potter. Which gallery is it? No, it's in a temporary space because they're doing work on the other one. I don't
What's
know exactly.
What's it called? Blood?
Blood, Attract and Repel.
Oh, okay.
And you have people like the Hotham Street Ladies. We have made a show called U Butte, a mural installation of uteri designed to celebrate the taboo of menstruation.
Oh, lovely.
So if you look forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another guy called Bas Stitgen, who's done blood objects made from early plastic invented in the 1850s in France.
Made
from sawdust and blood. And this guy mixed sawdust and blood and made, that was his new plastic
at
the time. And this guy's made objects out of blood. It's not human blood.
That would be a difficult resource to maintain, I would have thought, human blood.
Do you remember Mark Quinn? Mark Quinn made that head. It's quite famous in Europe. It came to Sydney in 2008, and it was a head shaped in his own blood. He'd taken his own blood and froze it inside of a glass cube, and that was made out of his blood. Mark Quinn, look him up. He's a real bug.
Wow.
I don't like him at all. So talking about that Madonna's knickers.
Yes, okay.
Apparently she took a court order stopping people from selling her old knickers because she was afraid that people might take her DNA and do something nefarious with it.
Where the hell were they getting her old knickers?
Well, that's a good question. Apparently people go through Bob Dylan's rubbish bins all the time.
Looking for Madonna's knickers.
Oh, that is hideous.
No, this is a big problem for a lot of A-listers or people go through their rubbish bins looking for stuff. And so Madonna's knickers are...
So she must have been concerned that they were going to remake her or something.
Don't know, but she's a bit concerned.
Cloning Madonna. I mean, if you're going to be able to clone humans, I'm not sure Madonna's the...
Or maybe you could use her DNA to implicate her in something and blackmail her.
Implication.
That's
it. A bit of implication.
Anyway, have you ever bought a Madonna record?
I don't know whether I have, actually. No, okay. I've certainly listened to plenty.
Yeah, just fine. Anyway, I'm not going to go on about Madonna too long.
Okay.
So I'm going to start a little thing about if I was a tyrant.
Yes.
Now,
new segment for the radio
show?
Yes. Oh, I see.
So if I
were a tyrant.
Yes, it could be a good song. A tyrant is someone who has power. It's not negative or positive, okay? So it's people think of a tyrant as being someone who's it's bad.
Mistreating
people. Yes,
it's
they
not
do.
Actually that.
Isn't it?
So if I was a tyrant, I would stop jogging.
No more jogging.
For anybody or just for yourself?
No, no, I don't jog. Forget a jogging. Why would you jog? Mm-hmm. It's just the most ridiculous
exactly.
thing.
I know.
No walking and talking with your phone.
No. Oh, yes, I'd be.
Okay.
Yes.
No staying in the right-hand lane. You agree with that one?
Yes, I do. Unless okay. you're overtaking.
Unless you're overtaking. Yes. No staying.
No I mean, staying. Fair turn, enough. Yeah. Yes,
okay.
yes,
which
yes.
is in Europe, it's against the law. Whereas in yes. Australia, it's not against
it's
the law.
It's so annoying.
Is, it is very annoying.
For all you drivers out there, could you just pay attention?
Move over. Mm. And no tracksuit pants outside the house.
Yes.
That's all I've got at this stage. So
okay, so
this
if
is
I were
not
a tyrant,
really if I were a tyrant, is it, Mark? This is just things that annoy you. It's a list of things that...
I like exactly. it, though. It's catchy, if I were a tyrant.
I would have thought that owners of refrigerated trucks would be in trouble.
Oh, my God. They're really getting there, John. We'll have to make some more up. So, look, now the other thing I want to know is we should be using more Aboriginal words for things that... For names like Uluru was changed from
yes.
Rock, which is great. I think we should be continuing this. For example, do you know Warragul Road?
Warragul Road.
Warragul yes. Road means Warragul means mad Aboriginal. Okay,
right.
So it's one thing which is being used, and I yeah. think if you drive in Warragul Road these days, you'll understand. But I think we should be changing things like the butcher bird should go to an Aboriginal name.
Uh-huh.
Because I know a butcher bird is called a butcher bird because apparently they spike on a thorn or something and leave them there like a larder.
I did not know
this
that.
This is why they're called the butcher
and the,
bird.
And the pied butcher bird has one of the most beautiful songs.
They are, look, they oh, all do. They are extraordinary songs. Yes. They're actually cousins of magpies.
Yes, they look
bird.
Like it.
I didn't
beautiful to listen to, but if you could understand the lyrics, you'd be alarmed, I think.
Possibly, yes.
Well, as we've said before, John, it's all about finding a mate, calling for a mate, or stating your territory, as you know. But it sounds great. Lyrebirds are not the same. And I think we should change the name of the lyrebird because
yes.
it's apparently they call them a lyrebird because they only saw them when they were dead and they had their tail looked like a lyre.
It does. Mm. Well, when they're alive, it looks like a lyre as well.
Not so much. Apparently.
Yes, it does pretty much. I've seen, curiously, actually, I my entire life I had never seen a lyrebird until I went and visited a friend of the show, Sarah Faulkner, the painter's place down at Combine Bar, and we drove into Combine Bar and saw about four of them.
Mm.
It was very exciting. Mm. And they were... surprisingly beautiful and long, the tails.
Yes, the tails are extraordinary. And if you go to Sherbrooke Forest, there's quite a few up there.
Are they?
There
yes.
were. A kangaroo. Do you
yes.
know why it's called a kangaroo?
No.
It's misheard.
Misheard, yeah. There's a couple of soldiers asked in Aboriginal, what's this big thing hopping around? They said, we don't know.
Kangaroo.
And they said, it sounded like kangaroo, so they called it a kangaroo.
That's one of those awful myths.
You can check it up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Urban.
Where am I
getting I think the urban myths, like Moomba.
Yeah.
You know. Moomba yes. apparently means something I'm not allowed to say on air, apparently.
Yes.
Well, look, that's the thing. How wrong we can be. I think that should be a topic also.
Another one. How wrong,
how
we should
wrong
be.
Have we been all through time and
yeah.
how we are still wrong? And I was reading about birds and how they, for a long time, they thought that all the birds came from Northern Europe down to Australia. But yeah. only in the last 10, 15 years, they've realized, in fact, they've started in Australia
and
gone
headed
out,
the other way.
Headed the other way. And this is, what again, an example of just how.
Well, the great wrong that we've all been. Of course, is the cosmic wrong where for a long time mankind has understood that things can only get better, but in fact the opposite seems to be true.
The opposite seems to be true, that's absolutely right.
What are you comparing to, John? Garden of Eden?
No, things can only get worse.
Well, entropy, you're talking about entropy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, mm. which yeah. is the
yes,
you know, things,
that things are slowly disintegrating.
Yes.
yes.
Although apparently the universe is expanding, so whether that's disintegrating or not is another question. It's like the idea of is there life in the universe? And someone said if there's not, it's a really big waste of space.
Yeah, I like the concept that there's a lot of universes, that we live in a multiverse, and that they're all in various states of expanding and shrinking, and that every possibility is represented multiple times somewhere, and that we aren't great fortunate sort of results of something that we don't understand. We are, in fact, inevitable.
Yes, so that, remember last week we were talking about sperm, and
yes.
we were saying, you know, we're 1 in 500 million or something
one
like that.
1 in 50 million.
1 in 50 million, Perhaps there's somewhere else in the universe all those other ones get a go.
Well, I don't care what happened to them, as you know.
Hey! Hark!
What is that?
It's time for the news. Thank you very much, Brody. Yes, it is. It's time for the news. We have got Stephen Halley out of place on at McClelland Gallery, a collection of paintings, videos and photographs exploring global urbanisation and the dawn of the digital. Mm. It's on until December up there. The International Film Festival is on now and until the 20th of this month, and Sengatan, the multi-award-winning short film that local filmmaker Frank McGree made about drug mule in Bali, is included in the short film category on the 13th and the 17th. Go to the festival website for
details. I had another look at their film.
Yes?
Oh, it's a terrific little movie,
isn't
it?
It's a great little movie, yes.
Yeah, there's a lot of tension, very good tension they've created there.
Of course, the Bell Shakespeare Company, Merchants of Venice, is on at the FAC on the 19th of August.
Mm.
Who? So where are we? Oh, the Bell Shakespeare Company? Oh, that's what you've spoken.
I've just
Sorry.
Said that, yes.
Go on, John.
Audible Peel launching a fundraising event. Charging ahead. We're raising money to buy a new generator that will ensure our wide broadcast capabilities. We're the leading community radio station in Australia and also a not-for-profit organisation, which means we're always competing for funding. Which is getting squeezed for all its arts organisations. So far, we're doing a great job competing with the big commercial stations, but we want to make sure our broadcast remains technically state-of-the-art, and that's where you and your support come in. Our first event is coming up. It's Jackie's Masterclass coming up on the 17th. It's an extension of her program, Taking Care of Business, and it's a morning of business tips, trends and prizes, and by coming along you'll be learning ways to expand and improve your business, and especially important, supporting your community radio station. Go to the station website for details.
Yeah, that's right.
Taylor Culity Lethlian.
Yeah, that's a tricky
word.
It is
a very tricky word.
TCL
to pronounce.
Has
yes.
opened applications to the 2018 Expanded Field of Landscape Architecture Creative in Residence program. Jesus. An initiative is set up in 2013 to honour the memory of Kevin Taylor, a founding director of TCL, who died suddenly in 2011.
Okay.
Programs open to individuals or groups from all professions or trades to explore our landscape and the civic condition in a creative project. Successful applicant will receive a project grant of up to $9,000. Mm. So the applications are open until the end of September. I'll put a link on the website.
Each spring, SiteWorks brings together artists, scientists and community voices to share ideas and knowledge evolving out of the
environmentally and culturally significant Bundanong. At the former home of Arthur Boyd and his family, the Bundanong Trust is located on the banks of the Shoalhaven River in New South Wales. Mm, this year's themes, Birds and the Bees, encourages a closer examination of local wildlife and ecosystems. The event will also engage with the subject of sex and reproduction through performances and engaging scientific research. That's one for you there, Mark. SiteWorks takes place on September the 23rd of September.
What Find sort out. Of performances are they going to be?
Well, that's go the to the website and have a look. Yes,
no,
indeed.
No, I never go to websites. Okay, Remote Drawings is an exhibition in September 2017 of Cameron Robbins' work at the Stockroom in Kyneton. His work describes the underlying structures and rhythms of natural forces using kinetic wind or water-powered mechanical systems. I like that idea. This will be the first solo exhibition since his highly successful Field Lines, a major exhibition at MoNA. Cameron is the first Australian artist invited to present his large-scale solo exhibition at MoNA. With luck, I'll have him on the show in a couple of weeks.
Yes, indeed. Yes, good. I'm going to have a chat with him. Now, if you've just tuned in, you've missed Arts About, but you can catch up with the show via podcast, which should appear on the station website sometime in the future. Shows repeating on air and streaming Wednesdays at 12. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to know what you think about the show, what you would like to hear, and also so you can get links and some of the things that we talk about on the show. You can do that by visiting our Facebook page. Like us and become part of our online community and have an input into the discussion. You'll find a link to our Facebook page on the RPP website. Join us again 11 a.m. next Sunday, and remember, everybody, we may not know everything about art.
One day we'll find out what Brody likes. He's the man behind the curtain.